Welcome to the Promise Institute podcast, where we share critical conversations on human rights, a production of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA Law. Be sure to stay tuned after the episode to learn about ways to follow the Institute and to support our work.
Hello, and welcome to this series of podcasts in which we'll be talking about the proposed new international crime of ecocide. I'm Kate McIntosh of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA School of Law. And this series is timed to coincide with the launch of our online symposium or collection of papers under the title An International Crime of Ecocide, New Perspectives, which examines ecocides from a whole range of different angles, such as how ecocide might contribute to environmental justice and reparations for climate harms, how it relates to the rights of indigenous peoples and rights of nature, how to establish the mental element of the crime, as well as a number of case studies, including Jamaica, Brazil, and wildlife crime. The symposium papers can be found on the website that we host, along with the Stop Ecocide Foundation and the Human Rights Consortium at the University of London, ecocidelaw.com. Today, I'm with authors Daniel Bertram from the European University Institute in Italy and Shirlene Chin of Green Transparency to explore how the crime of ecocide should best be brought into law. Before we get started, I should say that all of the papers in the symposium engage, although not necessarily exclusively, with the definition of ecocide proposed in June 2021 by the independent expert panel convened by the Stop Ecocide Foundation. I was a member of the panel, which was chaired by Philippe Sands and Dior Falsau, and more information about the panel, along with its proposed definition, can be found on ecocidelaw.com. So, Daniel, I'll turn to you first. In your paper, you examine a number of options for bringing ecocide into law. Can you start by laying out for us what those options are?
Thanks very much, Kate. It's a pleasure to be with you and Shirlene and to be talking about this very timely and important topic today. Yes, so you asked about different options towards making ecocide an international crime. And that is indeed the question that lies at the heart of my contribution to the symposium. I think that at the national level, we're probably all familiar. I have a rough idea, at least, about how criminal laws are made. There's a well-known legislative process with multiple readings, etc. But we don't really know how this plays out at the international level, where there's no central legislature and no clear plan for adopting new criminal laws. So in my paper, I look a bit at how that works and how that might play out in the case of ecocide. So as you mentioned, there are various options. I think the first and probably foremost option at the moment is to use an existing institution and an existing international treaty and add ecocide, the international crime of ecocide, onto that treaty. And that treaty is the Rome Statute, which was passed in 1998. In the Rome Statute, there are currently four existing crimes, as many people will know. Those are genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and more recently, the crime of aggression. And the good thing about the Rome Statute is that it does recognize an amendment procedure to add new crimes or change the text of the treaty. And how that procedure works is one state in the beginning has to come forward and say, hey, we would like to add a new crime to the Rome Statute. It has to formally propose that amendment. That amendment would then be considered by all the 123 members of the Rome Statute in a formation that is called the Assembly of State Parties. So that's the sort of legislative body in this case. And then they would consider that either in sort of committees or at the annual meeting of the Assembly of State Parties, or eventually at a review conference, which is what happened with the crime of aggression. And eventually, then that amendment would need a two-thirds majority in order to be adopted. And importantly, even after adoption, the amendment would only apply to countries who ratify the amendment explicitly. So it would not apply to all 123 states of the Rome Statute. One example where this sort of amendment process has happened is the crime of aggression. And Shirlene has written an excellent study on that, and I'm sure she'll tell us more about this in a minute. And this sort of Rome Statute amendment process is the option that's favored by the Stop Ecocide campaign right now and by loads of people. And I think it's the most sort of visible option. Another second option would be to negotiate an entirely new instrument that heralds an international crime of ecocide. And that means that states would need to appoint a sort of committee or group that's charged with developing a new instrument, a new text, a new treaty, if you will. For instance, this happened with the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species from 1973, which obliges countries to criminalize illicit wildlife trade in certain cases. So some experts also see significant potential in this option. For instance, I think Richard Falk is one of the longstanding advocates for a separate new ecocide convention that is, you know, separate from the Rome Statute. There are also some other options in theory. For instance, if enough states decided to adopt national laws criminalizing ecocide, eventually one could imagine an international custom arising or an international customary rule that would also require states to recognize that there is an international customary rule. So that might probably take some time, given that there's a relatively, small number of states that criminalize ecocide these days. Another option would be to adopt some sort of a soft law instrument that has no binding force, but that recommends some guidelines on how countries could or should tackle environmental crime, or even countries putting forward a shared declaration on their intention to criminalize ecocide domestically. But I think these last options are currently playing a smaller role. The two most credible options are really an amendment of the Rome Statute or adopting a new instrument.
Thanks, Daniel. That was a great and very clear explanation of the different ways ecocide could become an international or indeed even a national crime. Maybe you could just tell us briefly what your view is on the best course of action between those two.
That's a very, very difficult question, Kate. I wish I had a clear answer. I think no one has a clear answer there. And that's because both options bring various costs and benefits. To start with the Rome Statute, perhaps. The Rome Statute right now, I think, is mostly the favorite option because it's very visible. It comes with an existing mechanism for enforcement and adjudication, which is the International Criminal Court in The Hague, which started its operations in 2002 and has, you know, has a 20-year history of prosecuting and judging international crimes. So that's a very big plus, obviously, that there's this well-oiled machinery that comes with the Rome Statute. Another, I think, advantage of that option would be that the amendment process could, in theory, happen rather quickly. It could be a rather speedy process. But I think that in practice, that assumption might actually break down. And I think Charlene's example of the criminalization of aggression is pretty insightful here. So I'm not so sure if this hope for a speedy adoption would necessarily materialize in practice. Probably a pretty big downside of the Rome Statute pathway is that some very big and important states like the United States, China, India, and others are opposed to the Rome Statute. So they don't participate in the Rome Statute. And that would certainly limit the reach of ecocide's prohibition or of ecocide status as an international crime. I would say, however, that the crimes in the Rome Statute have attained a special symbolic status in public perception and perhaps even in legal doctrine. There's some debate about this at the moment. And they're often even recognized by non-participating states. So, you know, that is not necessarily as big a disadvantage as one might think in the beginning.
Let me bring Charlene in to talk about lessons that she's drawn from looking at that process that you're describing, Daniel. So, Charlene, in your paper, you look at the adoption of the crime of aggression, which was activated after 10 years, and you draw some lessons for proponents of the international crime of ecocide, which the three of us probably are. Can you tell us what those lessons are?
Sure, Kate. Thanks. Thanks again. And Dana, I think, you know, you painted the picture quite clearly that this is not an easy process. It is rather complex. So indeed, I look at the crime of aggression, and simply because you know, it's the only other crime which was introduced to the Rome Statute. Now, in short, what lesson do we learn from this? It's a whole different ball game. So it, although it serves theoretically as a blueprint for other crimes that come after it, it is different in the sense that there was already political support behind the crime of aggression. There were also strategic plans set out and backed by a number of strong states parties to the Rome Statute to see the whole process through. And indeed, as you said, it took so very long for the crime of aggression to even become adopted. Now, the biggest lesson that one can take away from the amendment to include a crime of ecocide is that, yeah, truly, we will need a well-thought-out strategy and very strong political support at each level of the amendment process. Now, this is clearly because we cannot afford to take the same time it took for the crime of aggression to be adopted. And if one were to look at the four-stage process that Stop Ecocide International describes on its website, one would have to consider what I would call the ambiguous process. So here, suppose that the criteria for a proposal for an amendment by a state party passes. The Assembly of States Parties might then have to decide on whether or not to decide on the amendment there and then during the Assembly of States Parties, or convene a special conference. Now, there was only one review conference that was held, and this was tied in a way to the consideration of the crime of aggression. By the time the first review conference in Kampala happened, plans, like I said, the strategy was already well thought out for the crime of aggression. Plans were already there with, you know, what I mean here by they already had a definition. And the only other thing that was discussed during the review conference was the exercise of jurisdiction of the crime of aggression. Now, during that review conference, states parties, they were divided on how the exercise of jurisdiction of the crime of aggression should play out. So as a result, there are two different ways for the court to exercise its jurisdiction over the crime of aggression. Now, what we do not want to happen to the crime of ecocide is that states parties become too obsessed with how the crime of ecocide should be invoked by the court. So therefore, my recommendation, at least from the paper, is that one needs to look a little bit further into that little step between amendment and adoption of the crime of ecocide, and to make sure that if there would be a state party backing this up or even proposing this in the first place, that not only would it have the support of other states parties, but also that these state parties or state party would be in it for the long run, supposing that this drags on, and hopefully that it doesn't drag on for too many years.
I think that's really interesting, Charlene, and thanks for sort of fleshing out not just the procedural aspects, but perhaps some of the political or social aspects, which brings me back to you, Daniel, and your paper. So you have some interesting reflections in your paper, and I think the topic of your PhD, in fact, is looking at the social aspects of international criminalization. How does your thinking about that intersect with what we've heard Charlene say about the kind of likely course or some recommended courses for criminalization of ecocide?
Yeah, that's right, Kate. This is actually where most of my interest lies, because the legal processes are there on paper, but how they play out in practice is a whole different thing. It's a whole different ballgame, as Charlene's paper really demonstrates. So I think that is where the crux lies. That will be the litmus test for ecocide as well, how the sort of political and social construction of ecocide as an international crime plays out. I don't have any sort of concrete recommendations there, but if we do look at the history of how international crimes have emerged in the past, what's clear to me is that there have always been strong social movements pushing for the prohibition or criminalization of certain conduct. You can see that, for instance, with the crime of genocide, which was basically the brainchild of a Polish lawyer called Raphael Lemkin, who spent his entire life advocating for this, pushing for it, knocking on the doors of international of diplomats and decision makers. And eventually in 1948, the Genocide Convention was adopted, and then later also influenced the text of the Rome Statute, obviously. And another example would be the criminalization of wartime rape, actually in the negotiations that took place at Rome and later led to the Rome Statute. That was a new thing. Rape was previously not considered a war crime in international law. That is something that really only emerged in the middle of the 1990s. And it very much seems that the input of feminist movements or feminist organizations was crucial to getting there. So I think if there's a lesson to be learned, it's that it will take more than just some stale legal processes that need to be, legal buttons that need to be pushed in order for ecocide to become an international crime. It will take a lot of political contestation, political engagement, and continuous social pressure being exercised by grassroots movements and actors in order for ecocide to eventually materialize in international law.
And of course, we know that grassroots movements and civil society actors, their initial target, of course, are usually states and their own governments, and that, you know, their own governments, at least in theory, are somewhat responsive to that. And I just want to bring in the idea which you alluded to in your initial remarks, Daniel, about progress on national level and how national moves to criminalize ecocide could build towards the international crime. I mean, since you wrote your papers, both of you, since we all wrote our papers, we've seen movements on the national level, quite significant ones in Belgium and more recently in the European Parliament, where the proposed revised Environmental Crimes Directive actually mirrors the language, more or less, that the independent expert panel put forward as a potential definition for the international crime. I wonder whether national level is where we're most likely to see advances on this at the moment. And I should mention that another member of our group, Jalma Borchardo, who's a lawyer and professor at the Uni Christus University in Ceará, Brazil, has written a really interesting paper that catalogues ecocide laws in existing national jurisdictions. So I encourage listeners to look for Jalma's paper on the website. But Shirlene, taking into account you're part of the Stop Ecocide campaign, you're following these developments closely, taking into account, as I said, these movements at national level, as well as what both you and Daniel have been saying, what avenue do you think is currently the most promising?
Thanks, Kate, for that question. Indeed, you touched upon EU movement behind it. The trialogue is taking place as we speak. What I think would be very crucial for this movement, this campaign moving forward, is a little bit more national support from, let's say, the global south. So although we have seen a lot of progress and willingness by Western, Northern European countries, I think that it is very crucial for the sake of advocacy and then tying back to what Daniel just mentioned about the building of custom, that such developments nationally to amend criminal laws or environmental law crimes, it should also happen in the global south, or at least countries that are already experiencing, you know, sea level rise. And one could imagine, you know, Vanuatu perhaps taking this up and looking at their criminal laws to see whether or not an amendment is necessary, or an addendum or an annex should be necessary. So yeah, I definitely support, you know, a top-down approach as well as a bottom-up approach. So bottom-up approach being, you know, developments under national law, so that can be built up by parliamentarians and also grassroots civil society, but also top-down, so state-led efforts, and the states that are leading in this discussion right now should definitely stay on top of the game. You know, we are in this for the long run, perhaps.
Thank you so much. Daniel, do you have final remarks you'd like to make?
Many, but I'll try to keep it very short. Just to mirror what Shirlene's been saying, I'm completely on board with her suggestion that a lot of exciting stuff is certainly happening in European countries and at a European level at the moment, but the entire international criminal legal enterprise has previously been criticized as being reflective mostly of the interests of the global north. So what I really hope to see going forward is global south engagement with this idea, countries from the global south pitching in more sort of detail and more actively than perhaps is currently the case, and perhaps even adopting ecocide laws nationally as well, participating in this debate to a greater extent to make sure that an eventual crime of ecocide truly reflects the interests of countries in the global south who are often more affected by ecocidal harm perhaps than countries in the global north, just as much as more wealthy countries in the international society. So I think that would be my closing remark, perhaps a hope for the next steps.
Thanks, Daniel. And I would just say, I mean, Shaleen Namecheck Vanuatu, who've shown astonishing leadership in this area and have spoken at the ASP in favour of the amendment, as well as, of course, being behind the advisory opinion on climate change, the request at the International Court of Justice. But I'd also mention Brazil, which I don't know if you followed that. I think last week, a draft ecocide law has been presented to the Brazilian parliament. So, I mean, there are moves going on across the globe, which is very encouraging. Okay, well, thank you both very much. As a reminder to the listeners, this podcast is one in a series of 5 conversations around different aspects of the proposed new international crime of ecocide. And it's time to coincide with the launch of our online symposium on the same topic, which you can find on ecocidelaw.com. Each of our interviewees on the podcast, including Daniel and Shaleen, who are with us today, has authored one of the 15 short papers on the site on issues ranging from how ecocide applies to bauxite mining in Jamaica or to international wildlife crime, to how to establish the mental element of the crime or contribute to environmental justice. The site also hosts a regularly updated annotated bibliography, which lists and summarizes publications on ecocide, as well as information on the proposed definition and legal developments around the world. So if you want to know more, visit www.ecocidelaw.com.
Look for the Promise Institute on social media. You can find us under the handle @PromiseInst UCLA. And please consider supporting our work by making a donation. Visit law.ucla.edu/supportpromise to contribute at any level and help make conversations like these possible. Last thing, make sure you're subscribed to the show to be sure to catch future episodes. Until next time, take care.